So what a great sermon title for this time of year. Did you look at it? Who doesn't love a vegetable garden? I mean, really, who doesn't? I mean, the Facebook posts and the farmers markets just abound with the joyous proclamation of vegetables. But it turns out there is someone who does not like vegetable gardens, and that's the prophet Elijah. So this being the Bible, we might suspect there's a tiny bit of chance that there is something besides eggplants and zucchini supplanting grapes at work here. But still, you know, wow. I mean, we stopped reading the scripture before we find out what sort of disaster Elijah has in mind for Ahab. But holy smokes, it's a huge backhand in payment for Ahab's veggies and an ill-conceived land deal. Sure, a guy dies, but the consequence is blood and gore and violence all around. No wonder no one preaches from the Old Testament, eh? It's like you cheat on your SAT tests, and you and your family spend the rest of your natural lives cleaning toilets at Walmart under active machine gun fire. It is that brutal. So the author of Kings does not give us much on which to hang a word of grace today, with what with all of the axes that he's grinding. Today's story has two of his perennial favorite axes at work here, royal theology and land theology. Theology, as you know, means the study of God. It's as if our writer believes that the use of human power to govern and who owns land and how it's owned are part of the God-human relationship. According to the Hebrew writers and also affirmed in Jesus' ministry, God's relationship to power is a little bit different than ours. God's relationship is to empower the weak and the vulnerable and to challenge the powers that be. From the very beginning of Israel's history, God has opposed kings for the simple reason that they inevitably take out their abuse of power on the most vulnerable. While the prophets and historians of the Old Testament are livid at Israel's kings abandoning the covenant faith, what really salts their socks is that the people permit it. It's as if they're saying that by tolerating the abuse and abuse of royal power for personal gain, the people are responsible for being abused. You know, that's harsh, wouldn't you say? That's harsh. So today's dilemma boils down to this. When the world skews toward injustice, can we preach the good news? I think we care about it because the good news changes the way that we see things, the way we see ourselves, the way we see others, the way we see the whole world. And that's the point. We see the skew toward injustice every time we hear about current events. But the good news points out that skew and puts the kilter back in the off-kilter of injustice. I am so fascinated that the good news changes the way we see things. Vision has become sort of a thing with me these last few weeks, ever since I found out that I'm going to need surgery on my eye to correct a little problem. I discovered the problem while I was stopped at a red light. Funny, I thought, I've never seen that light flicker before. And so I thought, oh, there's something going on. But I closed my left eye and the flickering stopped. And I thought, oh, cool. But then I closed my right eye and the whole light disappeared. Not cool. Not cool. So here's the amazing thing about perception. Not only does my right eye do a fabulous job of making up for what my left eye is missing, but my brain joins in on the perception correction game too. My brain, My brain doesn't just leave a blank spot. There isn't a blank spot in when I close my eyes. There's nothing blank there. It's like my perceptual portion of my brain has decided to take the edges and fill in what isn't there. It's distorted, it's bent, but it fills it in. It's kind of like a parable. It's kind of what I'm saying about the people of Israel. It's like the Oregon Vortex. Have any of you been to the Oregon Vortex, that house of mystery? All across, no one's going to admit it, I understand. It's okay. No one's going, yeah, there are houses of mystery all across the country. In Wisconsin, it's called the House on the Rock. And in this, there are whole rooms where balls seem to go uphill. And the people inside the rooms either grow or change or get smaller, depending on where they are in the room. And it's because the proportions of the room seem to stay the same, but the people are changing. And it's only because the room has been built so carefully out of plumb that it tricks our perception. We give an implicit consent to that trickery, and we believe that it's we who are out of kilter. That's what I mean by the people's responsibility for tolerating an unjust king. Now, Naboth happens to be the victim in today's story of this off-kilter perception. At first glance, it looks like a story about a land deal that was maybe overly advantageous to the king, but, you know, it's not much more than that. The king makes a low-pressure offer to buy the land that's very conveniently located next to him. But the writer gives us a couple of clues that there's more at play here. Forget for a moment that it takes probably 3 to 5 years before you get any good grapes out of a grapevine. Whereas zucchini takes 30 days and tomatoes take 66 days, those are an agriculturalist's concern. They're valid, but the writer of Kings has something else in mind. He makes sly allusions to gardens, and then the readers are supposed to say, oh, gardens, oh, that's about Egypt. Egypt was the gardening portion of the Middle East. It's about bondage. It's about being in bondage to annual crops. Whereas the covenant people and the promised land were seen as God's vineyard. So suddenly everything is just theologically loaded. The writer's been grinding this axe about the people's responsibility for bad leaders, and so it's no wonder that he implicates the whole town in Naboth's death. It's like a parable. He's making a parable here. They all come to the fast. They all sit through a kangaroo court, and no one says a word in Naboth's defense. They simply go along with the royal henchmen chanting, "Send him back, send him back." Despite understanding that land speculation is forbidden in the covenant constitution, they give implicit consent to the demands of institutional monarchy and just totally lose their memory of covenant. When the world skews toward injustice, do we even dare to proclaim the good news? Well, instead of pouting when Naboth would not sell the vineyard, Jezebel takes matters into her own hands, and she gives Ahab that all-important deniability. She has that ingenious plot. Like a candidate for public office who publicly hopes that foreign elements will hack another candidate's email, or like Henry II, who said, "Who will rid me of this troublesome priest?" And then was, oh, lo and behold, surprised when all of his knights kill Thomas a Becket. Deniability. But for Elijah, deniability does not take away the guilt. I just finished reading a book called White Trash by Nancy Eisenberg, and in it she recounts the American history from the viewpoint of the underclass poor whites. She documents how, from the very beginning, the original British colonizers, to the present day, in fact, but the original colonizers have taken the poorest and most expendable people in the nation and the bottom strata of our supposedly classless society, and these have been used as the manure to fertilize the fortunes of the wealthy 1%. The British aristocracy, who owned the land stolen from the original inhabitants, used that literal language, manure and fertilizing, in order to justify sending what they considered the most expendable people in the country to the colonies to reap the resources for their personal enrichment. To keep the hillbillies happy enough to stay in their place, to become manageable, they cynically established the institution of African slavery so that, and this is documented in so many words, so that they would have someone on whom to look down, and then they would be easier to control. They learned so well from Ahab how institutional power can be used to advantage. When the world skews toward injustice, to whom do we proclaim good news? So for whom would this story about Ahab be good news? You know, I skipped the part where Elijah tells Ahab in detail that all of the males in his household will die, all the men in the land, and that Jezebel's death will be particularly gruesome and desecrating. It's probably not good news to them. For the writers of the first five books of the Bible, as it was for Jesus in his ministry, Ahab, at the heart of God's kingdom, are the disenfranchised, the vulnerable, and the excluded. So in the previous chapter, remember early on it says it was at this time or later after this happened. Well, what happened earlier is that Ahab made a brother-to-brother sweetheart treaty with the king who had previously been the sworn enemy to Israel. Ahab does so at the very exact moment when he has the king in his custody, when he could have brought the guy to the ancient equivalent of The Hague to be tried for war crimes. And in exchange for giving this guy his freedom, Ahab gets the ancient equivalent of an exclusive contract to develop resorts in all of the contested territory that they have been fighting over. So this comes as the nation of Israel has been paying tribute to the aggressive foreign powers, something that God has explicitly told them, do not do this. And it's because the tributes have been taken out of the subsistence living of the peasants in the country, so that the nobility has not paid a single bushel of wheat. That Naboth even has a vineyard left after the crushing economic burdens of the peasants is nothing short of a miracle, and Ahab wants it to grow zucchini. Can we proclaim the good news when the world skews toward injustice? So my 95-year-old dad is a devoted and dedicated evangelical fundamentalist. He has spent the last 2 years utterly baffled by his religious cohorts who support government actions totally at odds with their professed morals and reading of scripture. So, like many people his age, my father has taken to crowdsourcing on Facebook. He's crowdsourcing on Facebook some explanation for this lack of cognitive consistency. His recent insight was that his cohorts are thinking in terms of individual rights. He says they may not do something themselves, but they say of others, well, he has a right to do that. And so they don't feel that they can criticize the person doing what they think is abhorrent. Sister Simone Campbell speaks to my dad's point as if she's been reading his Facebook page, right? But she published it on Richard Rohr's July 4th daily online meditation. Sister Simone is best known as one of the nuns on the bus. She comments on the civil rights movement as part of our nation's beginning to atone for the sin of slavery. Even though the movement came out of community, she says, it's been expressed in more recent times as civil rights that are an individual exercise of freedoms guaranteed in the Constitution. We drifted from the common good, she says, as certain groups and individuals began to think of rights as if there were only a certain number to go around. The remedy that she proposes is a commitment to developing a sense of civil obligation to sort of balance out the civil rights. The civil obligations would focus on concern and commitment to the whole, translating into such things as voting, educating ourselves and all of our children about not only current events, but about our form of government. Things like concern for the nation's future and learning to listen to differing points of view. And holding elected officials accountable for their actions. She concludes by saying that community is only created when the efforts of all of us are valued and used. We're not a nation based or founded on individualism, she says, but we start out our Constitution with the very words, "We the people," in order to form a more perfect union. So my invitation to you today is to continue proclaiming the good news. The world is skewed. There's no doubt about it. The world is skewed. But here's the good news. God's justice will prevail. And that alone is good news. Thanks be to God.